Chapter 7. The Coronation, the Confessional, and the Grey-Eyed Man of Mystery. Tuesday, June the 2nd, 1953. It had been a very long day. But what had Elizabeth expected? It wasn't as if any of her predecessors had enjoyed a nice and breezy coronation. It seemed to have gone relatively well. The TV cameras had made her awfully nervous. She had never liked being looked at. That was more Margaret's thing. But she had not tripped up or dropped anything, and considering how much her hands had been shaking at breakfast, this should have been verified a small miracle. As she stood in her dressing room, three pairs of hands dutifully removing all the necessary finery, she resigned herself to her fate. This would be her life now. She was the ruler of her people, the most public of their servants. Elizabeth decided that she needed some time alone. Philip was always so good about allowing her that. She dismissed her ladies-in-waiting, fastened the cord of her dressing gown, and made her way into the softly lit bedroom. It was already there, waiting for her on the writing desk, the large red briefing box. She had seen her father with that box more times than she could remember. It contained all the information the government thought the monarch ought to know. The gold letters on the front were so shiny that for a moment she wondered if the paint was still wet. ER2. Elizabeth Regina the Second. That's who she was now. The part of her people would care about. But how much of Lilibet would be allowed to stay in the coming months, years, decades? The transfer had been smooth, almost transactional. The whole system ran like clockwork. The royal wheel never stopped turning. She'd just become the new axle after the previous one had broken. It didn't seem to matter who she was or what she thought of the process. From now on, everything would be laid out for her. She would be advised as to where she should be, what she should say, and whom she should or should not meet. It would be very rare indeed for something to happen that was not premeditated, that she couldn't predict. There would, however, be exceptions. She hadn't noticed it at first. Perhaps the room had been too dark. Perhaps the vivid colour of the red box and the pressure that came with it had drawn her eyes so intently that she was blind to anything else. But as she became accustomed to the low light, she saw another box next to the first, the same size and shape, only this one was jet black. No one had ever mentioned a black box. She picked it up. Lilibet had always loved a mystery. Her father used to read her Sherlock Holmes when she couldn't sleep. Sometimes she had kept herself awake on purpose, just so that he would stay in her bedroom and read another. Elizabeth took the box to bed, feeling a little like a child peeking at her presents before Christmas morning. The smart brass latches opened with a satisfying click. Inside the black box was a book, its golden gilded pages glimmering invitingly as she picked it up. The cover was completely black, apart from three words written in embossed gold. Regius Nempe Confessionis. Elizabeth remembered enough of her Latin schooling to roughly translate. The Royal Confessional, the new queen whispered. Elizabeth opened the book. The first page was almost as brief as the cover. 22nd translation and edition. She flicked on her bedside lamp, turned the page and began to read. She wouldn't stop until dawn. The book was full of stories. Its authors, her predecessors, hundreds of accounts of English kings and queens, some dating well back over 1,000 years. There were stories of war. One page held a rather remarkable depiction of the Bayeux tapestry. Lilibet had seen the original as a girl, whilst on holiday in France. She remembered staring at it for hours, but she didn't recognize the section depicted in the book. It had the familiar figure of William in the same red, green, and gold, but there was another man whom she'd never seen before, a tall king with a jet black beard, a wreath-like crown, and a long coat embroidered with the most delicate flowers. The two men had their arms grasped together at the wrist, gold thread sewn in a spiral where they joined. Next to this image was an entry. Christmas Day, 1066.
It is over. The king is dead. Long live the king. England is mine, and I am now its true king. My coronation took place on this most holy of days. This seems only proper after the most harrowing pagan experience, one which has haunted my dreams these last 2 months. After reading this tome, discreetly presented to me by one of Harold's only surviving men, I realize that I am not alone. I am not the first ruler of this island to have had such an encounter. Mine took place on the dawn of October the 15th, in the morning after the battle in Hastings. I had left my pavilion to make water on a tree close by, but when I had finished, I could not find my way back. I walked between the English oaks while the sun rose in the east. It was then that I saw him. He was standing on the far bank of a small creek, dipping his bare foot in the water. As I approached, his lavender eyes fixed on me. He addressed me by name, which disconcerted me greatly. I certainly had never met anyone like this before. I inquired after his name, and he smiled at me. He introduced himself as England's other king, but made it clear, in perfect Norman, that he wasn't here to challenge me. He said he simply wished to continue the pact he had made with Harold. He told me of his fair people, how they would not trouble us if we did not trouble them. However, if under my rule the boundaries were not respected, the green not cared for, and the village offerings curtailed for the sake of a Christian enthusiasm, my people would suffer. The occasional child would go missing. The forests would become less safe, and I myself would experience nightmares that will make you wish for death. If, however, I kept the pact, my invasion of the isle would be the last successful one. I would be remembered as William the Conqueror for the rest of time. I took the other king's arm and made a vow over the brook. It felt as if the very earth itself was watching this moment. My heart quickened as a golden light began to dance where our flesh met. When it was over, he gave me the smallest of bows before vanishing into the trees. I turned in kind and found my pavilion in a matter of minutes. I am now king. I am the conqueror, and I hope never to see my counterpart again as long as I live. William the First. There were stories of monsters. On another page, Elizabeth found a depiction of St. George and the dragon. It was drawn like one of the Christian icons that were still popular all over Europe. It showed a knight in full armour on a white steed, lance in hand, riding so low in the saddle he looked in danger of falling. He was stabbing at a snarling green lizard with pink leathery wings and a vicious-looking tail. All that could be seen of the knight's face were his eyes, a peculiar shade, almost grey. Next to this image was another royal entry, the 23rd of April, 1350.
Why, you may ask, did I pick St. George?
I understand. A Roman soldier from the 4th century who killed a dragon in Turkey does not seem like the obvious choice for the patron saint of England. Truth be told, I was simply trying to cover up a rather embarrassing incident that took place some months before on top of a hill in Uffington, Berkshire. We had been getting the most ridiculous reports from the locals, uneducated types, farmers, hunters, woodsmen and the like. A dragon. Each of them reported seeing a dragon flying around, causing mischief. Of course, at court, these musings were first laughed off as just the imaginings of peasants. The last dragon of England had famously been killed 500 years before. See Alfred the Great's entry, page 17. But the chance to slay a dragon proved too tempting for one of my knights. Roland, the Duke of York's second son, rode off to Berkshire. He left on the 3rd of January, 1350, and returned on the back of a wagon on the 15th. His body was taken to my Privy Council chamber under the cover of darkness so as not to cause a panic. I still remember the smell. Burnt flesh and hot metal. Roland was still in his armour. It had been impossible to pry his almost melted body from it. My advisers were awash with theories. Was this an elaborate hoax? Did we break the pact in any way? Were the Dutch to blame? Eventually, we decided to discreetly send emissaries to the continent in search of a dragon expert. Word suggested there was still rather a lot of work for someone of that ilk on the mainland. The first expert arrived on the 4th of February. A Frenchman by the name of Thomas Toulouse, who certainly looked the part. He was a dashing young man with a deadly-looking lance, chestnut stallion, and bags of confidence. We were so sure of this champion that a royal procession accompanied him to Uffingham. Toulouse went up the newly christened Dragon Hill, but never came down. The next few weeks proved just as fruitless. As king, I thought it proper to station myself close to the scene, asking that potential slayers report directly to me. We sent up a band of ferocious Norsemen, a handful of brave knights hailing from as far afield as Capapudauchen, and a wizard. The wizard was the only one to return, the tip of his long cap lit like a candle. He said slaying the beast was beyond his capabilities, but that he did have a recommendation, a monk who could be found in a small abbey called La Iglesia del Hombre que Busca on the west coast of Spain. The idea of potentially sending a man of holy orders to his death made me uneasy, but I was at my wit's end. There had been talk that maybe the king himself had to be the one to slay the beast. I was keen to put those rumours to bed. The dark-skinned monk arrived on the 1st of April. He was dressed in a simple brown robe, entirely without weapons. The only possession he brought with him was a small wooden chest. I asked him what he wanted as payment if he were successful. Others had asked for gold, lands, or titles. To my surprise, and without explanation, the monk only asked that he be allowed to cut down one English tree of his choosing. Naturally, I agreed. I then asked him what he would require to defeat the beast. He said he would need a white horse, a suit of polished armour, a long lance with a red ribbon, a bannerless shield, and the company of the king. He made these requests publicly, in full view of all the nobles and knights in the Berkshire encampment, all of their eyes, and the monk's two grey ones, fixed on me. How could I refuse? We were swiftly armoured, horsed, and making our way up the hill. The effect of the new garments on the monk was startling.
His dark skin and ebony hair stood in stark contrast to his shining silver armor, giving him an otherworldly look. His posture was different. Gone was the pious bend of a monk. Now a knight sat steadfast on the white steed, lance up, shield over arm, with that intriguing wooden chest strapped to the back of his saddle. On our short journey, I asked the monk exactly how he planned to kill the dragon. He smiled and said that he didn't intend to kill it, but to make it go away. Well, before I could protest, he continued saying that it was imperative I do exactly as he said if I didn't want to be burnt to a cinder. We heard the dragon before we saw it. A huge intake of breath and then the noise of bellows blowing over a blacksmith's forge of hot coals. All the earth at the top of the hill was dry and cracked, as if a great bonfire had been raging there the night before. We reached the summit, and I finally saw the beast that had been causing me so much unrest. Memory can be fickle, and did my mind play tricks on me? Exaggerating what was small, reducing that which was large? No. I feel confident that the beast was huge, unlike anything I had ever seen. It could have swallowed a heifer whole. The dragon's hide was scaly and green, its vast bat-like wings folded neatly. A long serpentine tail bore barbs the size of broadswords. The creature looked at us with two large orange orbs. The monk gestured to me to stay back. I did not need persuasion. The monk rode forwards towards the beast, as if to charge. But then, to my horror, he stopped. He removed his helmet. He spoke.
"Good morrow. I have come over the sea to meet you. I've heard tales of your might and how you have roasted men from all over the world. As you can see, I have taken your power seriously. I stand before you in the finest armour that this island can craft. I ride the purest horse and hold the sharpest lance. The king of this land himself has come to watch my attempt. Are you ready for me?"
The dragon raised itself up on its two back legs, each as thick as a tree, opened its wings and roared. The monk returned to me with a smile. He threw me his small wooden chest, telling me to keep it safe as he would be needing it shortly. "Keep faith," he said, putting his helm back on as he began his second charge towards the dragon, his aim true, the horse at a gallop. As I watched, I thought this strange monk with God at his back may truly be the hero we were looking for. But then the monk's lance dipped. He tried to recover to rebalance himself with his shield, but this caused his horse to panic. The rider lost his seat, the tip of his lance hitting the dry, burnt ground. The monk in knight's clothing was flung into the air. He crashed to the floor in a tangle of twisted limbs. The dragon, upon seeing this, opened its mighty jaws and laughed. To all my successors reading this, you must believe me that I know this sounds peculiar. Dragons do not laugh. Dragons do not know of jokes or merriment. But there was no mistaking it. It was not a roar nor a snarl. It was a laugh. To my astonishment, the monk laughed too. He got up, dusted himself off as their mirth continued. When they were done, the monk began to speak again. I could not catch what he said, for I was now further back and out of harm's way. Then I heard another voice, a low bass timbre. It was coming from the dragon. Eventually, the monk remounted his horse and rode back to me.
"Your Highness, I have struck a wager with the dragon. All dragons are fiercely competitive. I will give it one attempt to burn me with its flame. You will act as referee.
If the dragon is unsuccessful, it will leave England and never return to these shores. If it is successful, it will eat you.
Well, I protested. The monk insisted that if this bet were not wagered, the dragon would eat us both. He then bade me open the wooden box he had brought from the abbey. Inside was a cloak of rich gold wool, as if woven from solid sunlight. It was a most wonderful garment. Accompanying the cloak was a small scroll, quill, and ink. The monk took the cloak and strapped it to his shoulders before unfurling the manuscript for me to read and sign. I have had a copy rendered over leaf.
Elizabeth quickly turned the page. I, the rightful monarch of England, hereby decree that I shall perform the role of referee in a contest of strength on April 1, 1350. If my champion is successful, my adversary shall leave England's shores, never to return. If my champion loses their life, I shall allow the winning party to consume my flesh in any way they see fit. Elizabeth flicked back to the king's entry. Reluctantly, I signed the scroll, conscious of the fact that it may be my last act as king. I comforted myself with the possibility that the scroll may survive me, proving my bravery to anyone who encountered it. The monk thanked me for my faith, returned to the dragon, scroll in hand. He bid I follow so I could do my duty fairly. As I edged closer, I could hear the dragon clearly. Its English was most impressive. It asked to see the document. Upon seeing my crown and signature, it seemed satisfied and asked the monk if he was ready. The monk nodded. He swirled the cloak over his shield, using the red ribbon from the lance to hold it in place, creating a crimson cross emblazoned over a field of gold. Smoke began billowing from the dragon's nostrils, the hungry look of the gambler filling its eyes. Fire came forth in a brutal jet of orange and blue, hitting the shield with a tremendous force, the heat so intense it was as if I stood next to an open kiln. I could only catch a glimpse. The monk crouched behind his shield. The gold of the cloak turned white hot, the red cross flashing brilliantly for a second before it turned to ash. When the beast finally tired, the ground all around the monk was blackened. The monk, however, was unharmed. He stood up with a smile, wrapping his undamaged cloak before throwing it towards me. I caught it. It was cool to the touch. Just as I never imagined a dragon could laugh, it was even stranger to see one look stunned. But the beast was true to its word. With a gracious bow and a mighty beat of its wings, the dragon took to the sky and flew off towards the sea. On our journey back down the hill, I had many questions, but only one was answered to my satisfaction. When I asked how I should explain the lack of a carcass, he responded thus. Tell them this was a holy apparition, no horrible monster, that the Lord had sent a vision of one of his chosen saints. Surely one of them has killed a dragon. Tell them that the men before us died because it is unsafe for an unanointed man to look directly upon the work of God. Understand? And that was it. That was the story we gave to the nobles waiting to hear of our success, that this dragon incident was simply a holy message from God. I relayed truthfully the only image of the conflict I'd seen. A man in armour, untouched by dragon flame, brandishing a white shield with a red cross. The monk gave back the armour, the horse, the lance, and the shield. He parted with a polite nod of his head before setting off on foot to find his chosen tree, singing as he went. I only caught a few words.
Soon may the good day come, when God's cruel plan shall be undone. One day you'll be in my arms, but until that day I'll toil.
I tried not to think on it too much. It certainly didn't sound like any hymn I was familiar with.
And that, my successors, is why I chose St. George.
Edward III. Elizabeth devoured the book. The sun was rising when she finally finished. She was exhausted, and she knew she should try and get some sleep, however fleeting, before her servants came to wake her. Yet something was niggling at her. A similar phrasing in different entries. November 7th, 1605. Folks blabbed after his third day in the tower, but his dark friend has yet to make any sense. I went to observe myself, but I found his unblinking grey eyes unnerving. As I left, he was ranting. It's under Parliament, that's where I buried it. James I.
May the 4th, 1380. He was said to be dancing around the henge and screaming. A naked man with dark skin and mad grey eyes, caressing every stone as if looking for something that was not there. And when attempts were made to restore his decency, he ran from the men, and the chase went on for hours. Richard II. November 12th, 1111. He insisted I needed to ride to Cerne Abbas as the Day of Wands was approaching. There was no hint of jest in those grey eyes. I think he really was looking for giants. Henry I. March 15th, 1595. He jumped right onto the stage and demanded to see the author. His dark skin and striking gold cape is something I shall never forget. Elizabeth I. The dark man with grey eyes turned up again and again and again. Sometimes a monk, sometimes a king, and even once an outlaw. Always searching for something. When Susan, the Queen's chambermaid, entered with the monarch's breakfast, she saw her charge was still asleep, book in hand. This came as no surprise. Elizabeth had always been a keen reader. Susan gently removed the book from her hand, placing it on the bedside table. What she was reading was none of Susan's business, but the book was so beautiful, its gold lettering so striking, that her eyes couldn't help but linger on the open page.
Those grey eyes I saw beneath the hood in that cold castle in Nottingham have haunted my every night since. John, King of England.
You've been listening to Evergreen, Chapter 7, written by Sam Russell and read by Catherine Russell. If you enjoyed it, give it a like, a subscribe, and even write us a little review so we can get this story into more people's ears. And if you really liked it, you can support this project on our Ko-fi page. All the details are available on our Twitter, @evergreenbook1. The next chapter will be released on Monday, the 6th of July. Thanks for listening.